wild pig. He had it roasting on a bed of coals. I felt famished, and it was delicious. Toron let Ram and me sleep that night in the canoe, which had been carved from a single enormous log. Next morning they dragged it back into the water and paddled down the stream. We came to shallows where the men had to wade and pull the boat, and several times we stopped to let the men forage or hunt. Toron made us stop at a ruined shrine and ordered his men to clear away the jungle that covered two great figures side by side on a throne, the black giant with the crown of worlds on his forehead, and his white woman companion, an altar before them. "Anak," Ram murmured, "and Sheko. He comes back to me now. He was the hero who brought men to inhabit the world. She was his queen. She grew jealous when he loved a human woman, and she killed them both." The men kindled a fire on the altar. Toron had Ram stand behind it while he led his men in a chanted litany, and then slashed the captive's wrist, caught blood on a slab of bread, and tossed it into the fire. Ram stood there in the smoke, his features set hard, staring off into the jungle. His uncanny likeness to the figure of Anak sent a chill down my spine. Late that day we reached what must have been a city. The river ran through it in a stone-walled channel that was overhung with trees. I caught glimpses of great stone columns towering out of fallen masonry. But Toron made his men lean to their paddles. They didn't want to stop. On the seventh day we reached Blood River. Dyed red-brown with upstream silt, it was an inland sea stretching flat for a mile or more to the jungle wall beyond it. The men laid their paddles down when we came into it, bowed to Ram, dipped its dark water from their cupped hands, and drank to him. Looking uncomfortable, he bowed in return and muttered his thanks. "I'm happy they didn't kill us," he gave me an uneasy frown, "but I don't like to be taken for any kind of god. I don't want the consequences." I couldn't help thinking how far we had come from our classrooms at Eastern, or wondering if we would ever get back. The captive lay sprawled on the floor of the canoe. I think he had a fever. For a day or two he had seemed to be hallucinating, shouting, screaming, chanting in an eerie monotone, but now he was sunk into a lifeless torpor, never moving except to whimper for water. Flies buzzed around his untended wounds. Chapter 14 Blood River was home to the men. They laid their paddles down, content to let the dugout drift with the current. I was shivering, hungry, scratching at swollen insect bites, wet from a drizzling rain, and not so happy with the river. Running fast and high, it threw me into a dismal depression. It was too vast and too strange. The endless flat bends reached on forever, twisting from jungle wall to jungle wall like a monster serpent crawling. It had cut its channel ages before the trilithons were built. It would still flow on after the last life was gone. We were helpless atoms, lost in its uncaring current. Ram was more cheerful, or at least more stoic. He tried to help the moaning prisoner, bringing him water when he whimpered for it, offering him a crust of bread he couldn't eat. He found a handkerchief in his pack and tied it around the wounded arm to keep the flies away. And the rain ceased at last. A pale sun shone through the clouds. Yet, still, a terrible loneliness haunted me. Searching for any crumb of comfort, I saw a few birds flying high. A fish jumped now and then. Once a gaudy butterfly perched for a time on the prow. But I saw nothing human, nothing else alive. Ram was learning more of the language and trying to teach me what he could. Staring at his birthmark, the men whispered among themselves until Toron hushed them. Ram kept an uneasy silence with them, but he shared his apprehensive uncertainties with me. "They think I'm some kind of messiah that the priests have been predicting, a son of Anak, sent to lift the curse of Sheko left upon the world and set things back to right." gazing into a bend where high water had undercut the shore and great trees had toppled into the river, he paused for a wry little shrug. No job I ever wanted. The river carried us past dense stands of palm and bamboo. I saw taller forest inland, but I saw no work of man until, at last, Toron pointed out a marble-white pyramid far off in the jungle. It looked as vast as those at Giza. He said it was the tomb of Anak. Ram asked if he had ever been there.
Who would go there? The question seemed to alarm him. Sheko breathed death upon it. Fools have tried to enter it, and died of fevers that rotted their bones.
He had the men paddle to keep us far across the channel from it, and they kept an uneasy silence until it was well behind. I wondered what Lupe would make of the strange ruins we had seen, and this even stranger folklore and myth. The hard bread and few scraps of dried meat had run out. My stomach growling, I rejoiced when the men threw hooks in the river and grilled their catch over charcoal on a pile of dirt in the bottom of the boat. A group went ashore and came back with bags of fruit and nuts and a straw basket filled with combs of wild honey. We filled ourselves again, and Ram huddled with Toron in the bow, learning what he could of the planet's geography and history. "I don't get half of it," he told me. "I don't have the words or the background I need, but he's literate and intelligent. He's been to school in Periclaw. That's the capital city down at the mouth of the river. He's not sure what to make of the birthmark. No more than I am. But he wants to know who we are, and he likes to talk." "Get all you can," I urged him. "Get us back home." "Worlds away, but I'll do what I can." He shrugged and shook his head uneasily. "I guess we're lucky to be respected, but I didn't come here to lead any revolution. I don't like a game where I don't know the stakes." Toron was telling him something about the planet. It had two major continents with names he translated as Norlan and Hotlan. Norlan lay over the pole, most of it under an ice cap. A white race lived on the fertile peninsulas that reached into warmer regions. Toron despised them. "He calls them the curse that Sheko laid upon the world," Ram told me. "Calls them arrogant tyrants who think they own the world. Bloated spiders, sucking blood till they bleed it dry." Hotlan straddled the equator with a chain of high mountains along the west coast. The great Blood River drained most of it, flowing toward the east. Its natives were black. Their civilization had been high when Anak ruled them, but they lived like jungle animals now, Toron said, since Sheko breathed death upon the world. Norlan claimed it, he said, and tried to rule it.
"It's too big for them to swallow, but they try with a high commission based in Periclaw and gunboats on the river." His fright mask twisted into a horrific grin. "The slave masters may be fat, but in the end, Sheko's curse will rot their guts."
Ram and I were sitting in the bow of the dugout, to keep as far as we could from the captive, whose untreated wounds had begun to smell. Ram glanced back at Toron, who was taking a turn at the paddle, keeping us well out in the rapid current. "I don't know how much truth he tells us, but he does spin a colorful tale. He says he was a slave on a cotton plantation down on the delta. He respected his white master, or so he says, and worked hard to earn fair treatment. He rose to be a field boss and got transferred to a better job in the cotton gin. The master was letting him learn to read and write so he could keep the gin records, till the day he lost his temper and knocked out an abusive mulatto overseer. He ran away to save his life, and finally found his mother's people in the jungle. He lived with them and learned their ways. He was a guide for a Norlan expedition searching the jungle for ruins of the old civilization. They found no gold. The white explorer refused to pay his Hotlan porters. They murdered him. White authorities captured them and auctioned them off in the Periclaw market. I don't know how to take him. Ram glanced again at Toron, bent over the paddle, magnificent muscles rippling under the tiger stripes. I want to admire him for all he's done, but life seems to have left him a cynic with no loyalty to anybody. He's a bounty hunter now, running down runaway hot man slaves. Ram nodded at the wounded man snoring in the stern.
That poor fellow. It's a price on his head for trying to organize a slave revolt. It was crushed, and he was trying to escape through the Trilithon, hoping, Toran says, to bring back that prophesied liberator. A fool's errand, but fools do believe the legend.
Ram slapped at a bug on his arm. Toran knows the legend, but he's only half convinced. Willing to treat me like the legendary liberator just in case I am. Ready to let us hang if I'm not.
I don't think I am. He made a wry face. His main concern is to deliver his prisoner to a government outstation down the river and collect his bounty money.
Next morning, the empty loneliness of the river lay heavy on me until Toran made out a tiny puff of black smoke far ahead. We paddled into a thicket of reeds in the shallows and hid there while a small steamer crept by against the current. I made out a long-barreled gun on the flat foredeck and bales of something stacked aft.
A government packet, Toran spoke and Ram translated. There's an excise duty on river traffic and a tax on slaves. They'd want to see official permits and search the boat for contraband Korath beans.
Toran grew animated when Ram asked about the beans.
The Korath is a sacred tree. He says the first were planted by Anak himself to show his people the way to paradise. They grow only at a few spots deep in the jungle where the soil is right. He says there's a secret brotherhood that worships the tree. They drink a tea made from the nuts that give them sacred visions.
A sort of narcotic, I imagine. He says a lot of whites are now addicted, users evading the taxes. Prices for the nuts are so high that they've become the chief currency here in the forest. The harvest is a risky business, because Sheko breathed death on the sites where they grow.
3 days down the river, we reached Hake's Landing.
A new deal ahead. We were coming around a bend, and Toran had pointed at a dull red dot in the green wall of jungle on the bank ahead.
Ram gave me a twisted grin.
Another game we've got to play with our lives likely at stake, and wolves will never know.
He had been an avid poker player. Now, in a better mood, he seemed cheerfully eager to see our new cards as they fell. For Derek and Lupe, the new knowledge they wanted had been worth any risk. For me, the game had become too strange. My own goal was now sheer survival, and I saw little to gain from what I saw as we came to the landing. A little red brick fort on the point of a granite ridge that thrust into the river bend, a bright sun glint on a brass cannon on top of the fort, a gnarled oak tree on a level drill field, a stake palisade around a few buildings, the dark jungle wall beyond, with all the secrets and hazard it hid. They had begun to prey on my imagination. Toran had asked to see our papers. We had no papers.
"You'll have to report to the agent," he said. "You'll have to register. But first I'll ask Trader Hake to help you if he can."
Toran beached the dugout below a wooden pier and left us there with a guard while he marched his limping prisoner to the fort. We waited, sweating under the tropic sun and slapping at stinging insects till he came back and escorted us to a palm-thatched building inside the palisade. Trader Hake was a tall, rangy man with close-set eyes and a long, narrow face and a sharp little tuft of iron-gray beard. We found him standing behind a cluttered counter, haggling with three black men who wanted to sell him a little black carving they said was a sacred seal of Anak they had found in a hidden tomb. He studied it under a lens and sent them away.
"Made yesterday," he told Toran. "In Paraclaw. I know the tool marks."
He listened to our story and scowled in doubt. He wanted more details, tried to question Ram and me, peered through his magnifier at the birthmark, and finally sent us back to the commission agent who lived in the fort. A black man in a stiff blue uniform stood guard with a heavy musket outside the agency door. He shouted through an open window, and the agent bustled out to gape at us in annoyed surprise. He was naked to the waist, a short, bald man with a stubble of beard on a fat red face and pale eyes blinking at us through thick lenses. Strong perfume failed to cover his unwashed odor. He shook his head at the traitor, squinted at the birthmark, frowned over my watch, studied my skin, finally shook his head and called through the window. A sleek black woman came out to join him, a brown-skinned baby in her arms. He had her open our packs and inspect everything we had, and finally took her aside to hear her advice. Ram motioned Toron aside.
"We're in an iffy fix." He came back to give me a quizzical look. "It's the Crown of Thorns that worries them. They're afraid of it, and afraid of me. Afraid I'll set off another slave rebellion. Hake doesn't want anything that might wreck his business. The agent wants no problems with his bosses in Paraclaw. They don't quite dare, but they'd love to string the two of us up along with that unlucky jerk they caught." He nodded grimly at the solitary tree. "Toron's trying to convince them that we did come through the Trilithon the way the gods did. He's warning them that I might be more dangerous as a martyr than I am alive. They think the birthmark could be a tattoo, a trick they've seen before. You complicate the problem with your white skin and your watch and your clothing. They don't know what to do with us." The agent and his woman came back to confer with the traitor again, and both spoke to Toron and Ram. "They've reached a sort of verdict," Ram told me. "The agent has put us under house arrest. We're confined to the settlement until he can report the case and get orders from his authorities down the river at the capital." I asked him what he thought. "No time for panic," he patted my shoulder. "Our luck has run wonderfully well. We have to hope it holds up." "Now that's hard to do," he shrugged and gave me a thin little smile. "Think about it, Will. We've made great history if we ever get back to tell it. Derek and Lupe will never be sorry we came, no matter what. We may yet stumble on some way to help them. For their sake, we've got to hang on."
He held out his hand and gripped mine hard when I took it. I resolved to hang on, to trust our luck, to take each day as it came. But next day we found the rebel slave hanging from the oak on the drill field, an iron hook through his ribs. Carrion birds were already perched above him, but he was still alive, whimpering feebly. I found him hard to ignore. Chapter 15. Traitor Hake put us up while the agent waited for orders from the High Commission. "Not because we're welcome guests," Ram said. "Toron tried to convince him that we really came here through the Trilithon, sent from heaven to change the world. He seems certain we're con men destined to be hanged. Either way, he sees us as a danger to his way of life, just in case we really are divine envoys. He wants to keep his options open." The traitor's wife, Lila Lu, seemed more cordial. She was a thin blonde with honey-colored hair that hung free below her shoulders. She had pale blue eyes and a wistful smile that seemed shyly appealing, but her fair face showed lines cut by a life that must have been unkind. She guided us down a long hall to a corner room at the back of the building and called a black maid to bring hot water for the bathtub. We bathed and let a black barber shave us. She brought her son to meet us, a bright-eyed child of 7 or 8. He was nearly as dark as Ram.
"My name is Kenlith Roynock."
He extended his open hand to Ram, palm up, and blinked in a startled way when Ram shook it.
"What is yours?"
With no fear of us, he was fascinated. He wanted to examine my watch and touch Ram's magical birthmark, and he asked questions we couldn't answer about the haunted Trilithon and how it worked. That night, his mother sent him to call us to the family dining room. 2 black waiters served the meal. There was excellent hard-crusted bread, but most of the dishes were strange, with no names Ram could translate. I was hungry enough to enjoy them hugely. Kenlith kept asking questions till his mother hushed him. She had little to say. The trader watched us sharply with shrewd queries of his own, alert, I think, for incriminating slips. When we sometimes failed to understand him, he offered to let his wife teach us the language, hoping, I suppose, that we would give ourselves away. She gave us lessons for as long as we were there. Never seeming to doubt us, she told a pathetic story of her own exile from civilized society.
"I was born in Paraclaw," she said. "My father was a history professor. He was interested in the native culture and the relics of the lost civilization. He took me to hear Goran Roynock, a black singer. We met at a dinner after the concert."
Old pain pinched her face.
"He became Kenlith's father."
She showed us a tiny bust of him carved in polished jet that she wore on a gold necklace.
"He was a registered freeman, a native of the Roy Roynoth tribe, nomads that ranged the northwest rainforest. An explorer heard him at a tribal ceremony and brought him back to civilization."
Emotion softened her voice and misted her eyes.
"He had a fine voice, and he sang the sacred songs of his people, oral epics based on myths of the lost empire, maybe composed before the art of writing was lost."
She wiped her eyes.
"I knew him several years. His songs made him a celebrity, but he also took my father's classes, did research in archaeology, and finally became curator of the antiquarian gallery at the museum. I was his secretary. We traveled together up the river, collecting historical artifacts the natives sometimes brought out of the jungle, and her voice broke. I became pregnant. That would have been a sentence of death for me and the child. My father wanted to arrange an abortion, but I couldn't kill Goran's child. I'd met Ty Hake on one of our trading trips, and I came down here to have Kenlith."
Her shrug seemed more resigned than joyous.
"Hake's been good to me, but I do miss the city."
She wiped her eyes again.
"Goran was hanged before Kenlith was born."
The agent made a ceremony of giving Toron his bounty money. Ram and I, along with the trader's family, were seated in folding chairs set up on the agency lawn, facing the old oak on the drill field and its evil-odored fruit. The agent's black mistress escorted Toron to join us. The guard detachment, 6 men in stiff white uniforms, marched out of the fort to the beat of a drum and waited at attention. The agent came out in a white jacket to stand beside the prize, waiting on a little table. He signaled for another roll of the drum. With gestures at the flag flying over the fort and the half-stripped bones in the tree, he read a speech about the dignity of justice and the blessings of life in the world union. The drums beat again. He called Toron forward. His black mistress presented the prize. 5 burlap bags, each stenciled with symbols Hake's wife read to us. "Korath, 1,000 top-grade beans." After we left, she showed us a Korath tree growing in a high-fenced yard in the compound, a savage-looking dog chained to it. It had long, leathery leaves and little pink flowers with an evil odor. The flowers and the fruit pods grew directly out of the thick trunk, not from branches. The ripening pods were violet-colored, shaped like footballs and about the same size.
"The agent planted it here to find if it can be cultivated."
She looked vaguely distressed.
"Oh, that outraged the natives. The Korath is sacred. The wild trees grow only in spots called the Gardens of Anak, where he is believed to have planted them. Members of a holy brotherhood drink the tea to see their way to paradise. Goran said Korath had been the inspiration for his songs. For an unbeliever to touch the tree is a desecration, yet many risk their lives to harvest the beans, their money here on the river. My husband accepts them for trade goods and grinds them into paste for sale in Paraclaw."
She made a bleak grimace.
"A dangerous trade. Forbidden by the natives except in the holy rites, and illegal to the High Commission unless a high excise tax is paid. But my husband says others would make the profit if he stopped."
She showed us the building where the raw beans were fermented, dried, roasted, and bagged for shipment. "I think it's our cacao," Ram told me when we were alone, "the source of our chocolate. I've seen the trees back in Africa. Apparently it has mutated or been engineered to carry some stronger narcotic." We were together there at the landing nearly 2 weeks. The Paraclaw authorities must have been as uncertain what to do about us as the agent himself. The first packet to come up the river brought him no orders for us. Waiting, with nothing better in sight, I grew more and more uneasy. "Let's learn all we can," Ram was philosophic. "Something we owe to Lupi and Derek." He asked Hake's wife about the history of the planet.
"Most of it's lost." Wistfully, she shook her head. "Norlan history goes back 1,000 years, but the early people were too busy fighting the ice and one another to care about much else. They had no contact with the South Continent until white explorers began cruising along the coast and up Blood River. My father was a student of what he called prehistory, but nothing to base it on except artifacts from the ancient ruins of the old civilization and the folk tales of the blacks. If you care about those myths and legends, the history of the world began when Anak and Sheko came through that gate on the sacred mountain, the way you did." She waited for Ram to nod. "They planted trees and put fish in the seas and freed the birds to fly before they brought the first men. Anak ruled the world in peace and shared his powers to let men build the gates to heaven, as well as the cities and temples that the jungles buried after Sheko killed him."
"Myths?" Ram asked her. "What do you believe?"
"Well, my father looked for some truth behind them." She frowned. "I worked with Goron, collecting for the museum. Enormous ruins still stand. Tombs are found filled with tantalizing artifacts. Walls are covered with writing nobody can read. There's Anak's pyramid with Sheko's curse upon it, and the gate to heaven that takes you nowhere."
Trouble seamed her careworn face.
"The blacks believe Sheko breathed death on the world and left her ghost to haunt it. Maybe she did, though that's hard to believe. Perhaps the myth reflects some great natural disaster. My father never knew what to think. He finally called Sheko's curse simply a metaphor for the evil in us all." She sighed. "It's hard to see any good future for my little boy."
"It was hard for me to see any good future for us." For exercise while we were there, I walked with Ram on a gravel path around the clearing, the little fort and Hake's palisade on one side of us and dense jungle on the other. Giant trees with grotesquely buttressed roots towered to a dense green canopy that shadowed the trail. Through gaps in the wall of undergrowth, I caught glimpses of brilliant birds. Enormous orchids blazed with colors and carried scents that tempted me farther than I wanted to go. Now and then I heard an eerie scream from something I never saw. And one morning when we were on the path, I heard a cautious call from the jungle. Toron stepped out of the undergrowth to beckon and step back again. The fright mask was gone, but he looked savage enough without it, with a bright red turban and a leather vest beaded with brilliant purple and orange. A wicked blade in a blue beaded scabbard hung at his waist. We followed him out of sight from anybody. He spoke to Ram, his voice so hushed and rapid that I caught very little of it. Ram kept repeating, "Mish," the word for no. Toron's lean black features hardened with anger until at last he drew his blade, slashed a hanging vine out of his path, and strode back into the jungle gloom. "I don't like it," Ram muttered. "I think he belongs to the Korath cult, though he never said so. He says I was blessed by Anak before I was born, marked with the crown of worlds, and sent through the Trilaton to liberate his people." He shook his head, his face gone as hard and bleak as Toron's. "Destiny I never asked for, and trouble we don't need." That night, I dreamed that Sheko's ghost had slipped into our room. She was skeleton thin, her head a grinning skull, her deep-sunk eyes as burning red as the hopper's headlamps. Her bone-thin hand clutched a blade like Toron's, dripping Anak's blood. A wisp of blue mist shining in the dark. She came to lean over me. Her breath had the foul stink of the Korath bloom. The glare of her eyes felt hot, yet I shivered from her deadly chill. Her bare teeth moved as if with speech, but I heard no sound. She left me in a moment and glided on to Ram. In the blue of her body, I saw him sit up in his bed, blinking at her. Her skeleton arms reached to embrace him. I heard him yelling, "Mish! Mish!" He held her off until she offered him a steaming cup of Korath tea. He gulped it down. I heard a piercing shriek. She flickered and vanished, but her evil odor lingered in the air, so powerful that it woke me. I was alone in the room. Chapter 16. The silence hit me first. We had snuffed the candle out when we went to bed. Hake's Landing had no electric lights. I called Ram's name and got no answer. I stopped breathing to listen and heard no sound at all. I groped through the darkness to feel for him and found the empty bed already cold. With no idea what had happened or what to do, I stumbled back to my own bed and lay there through the hours of another nightmare. Ram had been a strong companion and the best friend I'd ever had. Feeling helpless without him and paralyzed with fear for both of us, I knew I could expect no help from Hake or the agent. All I could do was lie there in the dark, hoping he would come back safe. Daylight broke at last. The black maid came in with a pitcher of hot water and a tray of ripe fruit. Seeming astonished by Ram's absence, she ran out to report it. Lila Lu came back with two mulatto officers who battered me with questions I seldom understood. They kept an air of distant respect that failed to hide a watchful hostility. The room had a single outside window with a wooden shutter but no glass. We had left the shutter open for ventilation. They examined the window and found blood smeared on the splinters. Ram, I thought, must have been gagged or knocked out and dragged through the window. But I felt too uncertain of anything to tell him about our encounter with Toron in the jungle. Lela Lu called me for breakfast after they were gone. I had no appetite.
"Eat," she told me. "You're going to need your strength." "I'm sorry about your friend,"
Kenleth eyed me anxiously when I came out to the family table.
"I'm afraid for you."
I ate a slice of toast and a few bites of a ripe papaya, and drank a cup of tea sweetened with a little cake of hard brown sugar. Hake came late to the table, with no more appetite than mine.
"An ugly thing!"
He rapped his cup on the table and waited for Lela Lu to refill it.
"I don't care who that Tai Chinchi was or where you came from. Tai Toron and his men have inflamed the slaves with their tales about him. They believe you two have come through the gate to set them free."
He gave me a searching scowl.
"Do you know where Chenchi went?"
"Mish,"
was all I could say. Lela Lu was offering us a plate of fried plantains.
"I'm afraid of insurrection."
Patiently he waved her away.
"I had two guards on duty last night, men I trusted. This morning, they're gone. You saw that hook in the tree at the agency? Last night somebody cut it off the rope and took it away. A gesture I don't like."
Neither did I. I was pacing the floor like a prisoner in my room when Lela Lu came to the door to tell me that the agent wanted to see me. His office in the fort was almost a museum of native art. Bright woven rugs covered the floor, grotesque wood carvings stood along the walls. His desk was cluttered with strange ceramic figurines that must have come from looted tombs. The black guards let me in. Seated at the desk, he squinted shrewdly at me through dark-rimmed glasses and spoke to his black mistress. She sat close beside him, nursing the brown baby at an ample breast. The language we had been learning was a lingua franca created by Norland traders. They must have been using her tribal tongue. I got nothing of what they said.
"Tai," he stressed the honorific, perhaps in mockery, "we've all heard your unlikely story.
Have you anything to tell me about Chenchi's disappearance?
Nothing, I said. Tai Chenchi wants to make no trouble for anybody. We do come from another world. We left it through an old stone gate we found in a desert there. We've been wandering since, looking for a way home. That's all we want.
Perhaps, he squinted at me sharply. How did Chenchi get that mark on his face?
He was born with it. He doesn't claim to be the heir to any god. He certainly had no purpose to make trouble here.
Purpose or not, he's made it. He dropped his voice to confer with the woman and finally swung back to frown at me. Tai, whatever he is, his absence leaves you in an awkward situation. If he involves himself in any slave unrest... The woman spoke, her voice sharply lifted. The baby was rooting for the other black breast. He smiled at them and turned back to frown at me. I don't know who you are, Tai Stone, but if you have any reason to ask me for help, you'd better speak now. She adjusted the baby and they waited for me to speak. I do need help, I said.
So does Ram Chenchi. He was taken out of our room last night. There is evidence of a struggle. That's all I know. I'm afraid for him.
You ought to be. The agent sat a moment with his troubled eyes on the nursing baby. Very soberly, he turned to me again. You ought to understand that your association with him could get you charged with treason.
Helpless, I could only gulp at a cold knot in my stomach and try to thank him for the warning.
You are sure you have no more to tell me?
I shook my head.
That was your chance, he turned severe. Perhaps your last. The Hotland police on duty last night looted the arsenal and deserted en masse. They took sidearms, muskets, ammunition, grenades. I don't know what to expect. He made a grim face. Except more trouble from your friend Chenchi, whoever he is. The woman spoke, and he nodded. Tai Stone, you will remain here at the landing under house arrest. You will not leave the palisade without my permission.
That was no problem. I had nowhere to go.
I've always been more spectator than actor. I try to blame my nature on an accident that I barely recall. My mother was arranging a surprise party for me at a neighbor's house on my third birthday. My father was driving me there when another car came through a stop sign and struck us. My father died. I spent several weeks in the hospital and had to learn to walk again. I still have a bad knee, and I envy such men of action as Ram and Derek. I used to enjoy our low-limit poker nights as safe adventures, but sometimes... I had to wonder how I'd been able to nerve myself to come with them to Africa. Now I knew nothing to do except wait for some decision by the High Commission down the river in Paraclaw and hope for good news of Ram. Back in the compound, the trader's wife asked me to biscuits and tea in the library room, where she kept what she could of her life and civilization. A few books, framed pictures of her family and the home she had lost, a tall harp she had tried to teach Kenleth to play. She wore a scarf over her untidy hair, and her face was tight with tension.
"The agent and his woman," she shook her head. "How did it go?"
I told her about the house arrest.
"You worry, Tai Hake," she frowned. "But I want you to know you're welcome here as long as you can stay."
I tried to thank her and ask what she expected.
"I don't know."
She sat with Kenleth close beside her, her arm around him as if to shield him from the crisis.
"It's a bad time. Our living here depends on trade with the blacks. We try to get on. Maybe some of them like us. Most of them don't."
A wide window that had no glass was open to the heavy scents of the jungle. Some wild thing shrieked out in the thick green canopy that hung so near the palisade. I thought she shuddered.
"I long for Paraclaw."
Absently, she was smoothing Kenlith's hair.
"Life seemed good, but here..."
Her thin shoulders hunched.
We live on the edge of a hot man's sea that can rise up and drown us.
I asked what she knew about the Korath cult.
Ah, not much, she shrugged. The Elderhood, a secret society of the blacks. My father thought it might date back to the old empire. They're said to use Korath to induce mystic visions. They think they own the jungle, and they don't like us in it.
Far away, something was screaming again, and she listened in silence.
I used to sit in my father's class on the conquest of Hotlan.
Her tone turned ironic.
A misnomer. There was no conquest, and nothing to conquer. The blacks live in 1,000 isolated tribes, with only trails between them, no vehicles or roads fit for them, no domestic animals. The tribes are independent and often at war, but my father thought the Brotherhood was a sort of shadow government, trying to unite them with the secret rites of Anak and fighting the Norlanders with a secret army. Maybe that's true. The Korath trees are sacred to the blacks, planted by Anak himself, the seed used only in their ceremonial rites. Its abuse by the whites is a sacrilege. But my father thought the Brotherhood had made it a weapon, selling it to corrupt and destroy us. I don't know, she sighed and drew Kenlith closer. A bad time, with worse to come. The river is rising, my husband says, and the levee leaking. His business is in danger. Maybe our lives.
I tried to talk to the trader when I saw him at noon. He laughed at his wife's apprehension. She's sick with fear for herself and the kid, he said to me. But I've survived hard times before. I told her not to fret. The agent expects a few more regulars on the next upriver packet, enough to hold the fort. We've got nothing here worth a fight. If trouble comes, it will be farther down the river. Yet her fears were hard to forget. Confined to the palisade, I took uneasy walks along that path between the clearing and the jungle wall, hoping in spite of common sense that Ram would step back out of it as suddenly as Toron had done. He never did. The storm broke one morning at dawn. A crash like thunder woke me. Some kind of bomb had come over the stakes. I heard men yelling. Smoke stung my eyes when I looked out the window. Yellow flame crackled in the palm leaf thatch of the Korath mill. Warriors waving long jungle knives came swarming into the palisade. Chapter 17. Kenlith darted into the room.
Ty, quick! He tugged at my arm. Mama says we've got to run!
I pulled on my pants and boots, grabbed my backpack, and followed him to the front door. The trader and his wife stood there, his jaw clamped hard on a narcotic wax he chewed, a long-barreled handgun swung at his hip. Get to the fort! He shouted at her. I'll save what I can!
Mish!
White and trembling, she clutched his arm.
I can't! I won't leave you to face them alone!
Think of the kid! He shook her off. He'll need you.
Come, please. They'll kill you.
Maybe not. I've handled trouble. Tears shone in his hollowed eyes. He brushed at them and reached to draw the gun. Save yourself. Save the kid. She hugged him for a moment, kissed his lean cheek, and we ran. Behind us, scores of natives danced around the blazing Korath mill. Black, half-naked bodies smeared with yellow tiger stripes. They were screeching out a tuneless song. I heard a gunshot and looked back again, but nobody followed. We found scores of frightened natives milling around the gate to the fort, clamoring for safety.